Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mark Casto, president of Casto Travel, and I will be moderating tonight's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Arthur Frommer, founder of the Frommer Travel Guide Series and the author of the new guidebook, Ask Arthur Frommer. Widely considered the nation's foremost travel authority, Arthur Frommer began his travel career in 1957 when he published Europe on $5 a Day. It was an immediate bestseller, and his writings were a major impetus for masses of American tourists to flood Europe. Today, Arthur is founder of the Frommer Travel Guides, the author of a twice-weekly newspaper column syndicated by King Features, and the host of a nationwide Sunday travel radio program broadcast to more than 100 stations by the WOR network. Among the many travel books and guides he has written is The New World of Travel, which took an in-depth look at the entire American travel industry. Recently, the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel wrote this of Arthur Frommer: "What Benjamin Spock was to babies, and Alfred Kinsey was to sex, Arthur Frommer became to travel." Like Spock, he wrote with the authority of experience. Like Kinsey, he opened up a whole new world. And while the work of these two men has been eclipsed by others, as well as by changing times and fashions, Frommer remains a powerful and indefatigable force in his field. So with great pleasure, please welcome Arthur Frommer.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It is a very great privilege to appear at the legendary Commonwealth Club of California. It proves that if you live long enough, all honors eventually come to you. You might be interested to know that one of your volunteers with whom I spoke earlier this evening was careful to remind me that over the 100-year history of the Commonwealth Club has hosted such personalities, and she pronounced the words very carefully. She said, it has hosted such personalities ranging from Franklin Delano Roosevelt to Rick Steves. And hearing the name of my competitor in travel writing mentioned in that word in that sense, I am properly awestruck by the opportunity to appear before you. Now, I have been assigned a very depressing title. I've been asked to talk about travel in these troubled times. And, of course, we're all aware of the fact that we're living through troubled times presently. But ironically enough, we are living through a halcyon era with respect to the ability to travel. The conditions in these troubled times have never been better in recent history for travel, as I hope to establish in the course of my talk. And what we have experienced this last year in travel can only be regarded as a great reversal of fortunes. 1 year ago, it looked like it was all up for all of us who earn our living in travel. We actually confronted a situation so dire that I started receiving letters from people claiming that the era of inexpensive travel was all over. This was a time exactly a year ago today when the price of oil hit a level of $148 per barrel, and every airline in the world began adding fuel surcharges to the cost of their tickets. And if you flew from the West Coast of the United States to the Pacific Rim, you often paid as much as $400 to $500 extra per round-trip flight, simply over and above the cost of your tickets. If you flew to Western Europe, even from the East Coast of the United States, you paid a fuel surcharge of at least $250, and more often for $300 and $350, all over and above the basic cost of the tickets. As if that wasn't bad enough, you had a situation with the U.S. dollar where our currency hit an historic low against virtually every other currency. As recently as 1 year ago, you went to Britain and you discovered that the English pound cost $2.10. And in order to obtain the U.S. dollar equivalent of the prices that you saw in England, you had to multiply by two and then add a little bit more to find the equivalent. The euro on the continent of Europe began selling for $1.67. And when you experienced a euro price, you had to increase that price by two-thirds in order to find the dollar equivalent. And then, if you'll remember, in August, a terrible event happened. We all woke up to the realization that the United States was entering into the worst economic recession since the Great Depression of the 1930s. And simultaneously, and for reasons that no one is able to properly understand, the conditions of travel went in exactly the opposite direction. The recession was recognized, and the price of oil fell from $148 a barrel down to $40 a barrel. It has since recovered, but it is only it costs $50 now to buy a barrel of oil, and there are no longer any fuel surcharges. The value of the U.S. dollar, in the midst of the most terrible recession that we've experienced in decades, the value of the U.S. dollar began to soar to such an extent that the dollar is now selling at an historic high. And no longer do you pay $2.10 for one British pound. You only pay $1.50 U.S. for one British pound. And when you convert British prices into dollars nowadays, you find that you're paying for your restaurant meals, for your theater tickets and the like, more or less what you would pay in San Francisco for the very same thing. Then not only did the dollar surge against the British pound, it surged against the euro. And this morning, and I checked it again this morning, the euro is selling for $1.35 rather than $1.67. That's a close to a 25% improvement, and suddenly everything has become moderately priced on the continent of Europe. Not only did the dollar surge against the currencies of Europe, it has surged to historic heights against every foreign currency with the single exception of the Japanese yen. When you travel today to Australia, one U.S. dollar buys $1.35 Australian, and everything in Australia has suddenly become 35% cheaper to Americans. A U.S. dollar buys $1.80 New Zealand. When you travel to Turkey, when you traveled there a year ago, one U.S. dollar bought $1.10 Turkish lira. Today it buys 1.67 Turkish lira, and suddenly everything in Turkey has become 50% cheaper than it was. And the same phenomenon is found throughout every country in the world today, in Central and South America, in the Middle East, in the Far East, in every country other than Japan. Ironically enough, in a mystifying fashion, whose only explanation can be that other countries are suffering worse than we are suffering presently in a recession, the dollar is selling at its historic high. And suddenly it has become incredibly inexpensive to undertake trips to far-off, exotic, remote destinations, and especially to go to the countries that are our nearest neighbors. A year ago, when you went to Mexico, you received 10 Mexican pesos for $1. You now receive 13 Mexican pesos for $1. And provided only that you change your dollars into Mexican pesos when you go to Europe, to Mexico rather, you find that everything has become absurdly cheap in Mexico, that you are today paying $80 and $90 per person per night to stay in a deluxe all-inclusive hotel on the so-called Mayan Riviera, the Caribbean coast of Mexico, and you're paying that little to go to the famous West Coast resorts of Mexico, provided you change your dollar. Roberta, who is here tonight, my wife, is in the audience, and I went into all sorts of shops on our most recent trip to the Mayan Riviera and saw one American after another paying for their purchases in dollars. And, of course, the Mexican shopkeeper, pinching himself for his good luck, proceeded to exchange those dollars into pesos at the rate of 10 pesos to the dollar rather than 13 pesos. To Canada, where until recently the U.S. dollar was selling at par to the Canadian dollar. You are now getting $1.20 Canadian for every U.S. dollar. And suddenly the thought of taking a trip to Vancouver to see this remarkable city, probably the fastest growing city in all the world today, has become a reasonably priced prospect for American tourists. And the idea of going to the great Canadian national parks, going to Jasper and to Banff, going to look at the most glorious visual sight in all the world, which is Lake Louise, as seen from the Fairmont Hotel, overlooking that extraordinary vista. The Mexico and Canada have become reasonably priced once again for the U.S. tourist, as have every country of Central America. One of those countries, Honduras, is so cheap that you can buy hotel rooms for $15 a night. You buy three-course meals for $3 and $4 a night. You pay a little more, but when you go to Panama and visit Panama City nowadays, you see an area of the world that is inundated with American retirees, all moving to enjoy the equatorial weather of Panama and to see the Panama Canal and to occupy more high-rise condos in downtown Panama City than have been built over the last 15 years in Miami Beach. You arrive at the airport of Panama currently, and you see a scene that resembles the financial district of New York City, with hundreds and hundreds of skyscrapers reaching up to the sky in a country that uses the U.S. dollar as their unit of currency, and that is so cheap that you pay $1.50 to book a cab for one end of Panama City to the other. And if you decide to go to the Miraflores locks on the outskirts of Panama City and see ships, these giant tankers and container ships transiting the Panama Canal, you take a taxi ride that lasts for about $45, and the fare comes to $3, as I recently experienced in Panama. So there, too, you have the best prospects for travel that we've experienced in the last 20 years in the midst, of this horrible economic slowdown from which we are all presently suffering. You find the same opportunities today in the remote, distant locations, and especially in China, where the Chinese government has deliberately kept its yuan low in exchange values and kept the U.S. dollar ridiculously high to such an extent that in Beijing today, when you take a taxi from one end of Beijing to the other, you pay a taxi fare of about $1.50, and you can now travel independently in China and simply take taxi cabs, provided only that you have the names of your destinations written in Chinese, which you show to the taxi driver. And because of this ridiculous imbalance in foreign currency exchange rates today, there is a San Francisco tour operator called China Focus, FOCUS, operated by Chinese Americans in San Francisco, that will be continuing to charge this winter in November, December, and January on all of their departures of a 10-day visit to China, on which they take you round trip by air from San Francisco to Beijing and back from Shanghai to San Francisco. They provide you with 9 nights in 5 Chinese cities. They give you all 3 meals a day. They take you on twice daily sightseeing by escorted motor coach. They throw in a couple of evening activities as well. And for this entire 10-day package, including round-trip air to China and back, you pay $999. And if you will go home this evening and go to the Internet and put in the words China Focus, you will confirm this incredible phenomenon that is a result of the strong nature of the U.S. dollar versus the Chinese currency. China Focus, by the way, now has a competitor. There is a young man named Wilson Wu who lives in Seattle who has recently started up a company called China Spree. And whereas China Focus schedules its $999 trips primarily for December and January, he is charging $999 in November and December. So between the two companies, You can still travel and enjoy a 10-night stay in 5 Chinese cities this winter during a time of frigid weather, but wearing warm clothing, staying in warmly heated motor coaches and in museums and in hotels, enjoying a China that is bereft of tourism at that time, that is available for such ridiculously low prices as this absurd situation brings to our attention. Amazingly enough, and though I know I'm repeating myself, in the midst of the most serious economic recession that we have suffered through since the days of the New Deal, the prospects for travel have suddenly mysteriously and mystifyingly have gone in the other direction. And suddenly people can today travel for less money than was needed even 10 and 20 years ago. And this is particularly the case if you make use of those airlines that belong to countries that whose economy has crashed. There are 3 airlines in particular that are announcing such prices nowadays for their tours as to make you want to rub your eyes. And these are, to begin with, the airline of Iceland, which is Iceland Air, and the airline of Ireland, which is Aer Lingus. No countries have suffered more from the current economic crisis than Iceland and Ireland. In Iceland, the 4 great banks of the country have now all been nationalized. The governing party has been thrown out of power and replaced by the opposition. The political figures who ran the country have been completely humiliated. Most of them have left Iceland. The average citizen is impoverished. The money is a joke. And as a result of that, Iceland Air, the flag carrier of Iceland, no longer has a national citizenry who will book seats on their planes, and therefore they must fill their planes solely and only through foreigners booking these flights. Starting in late June, out of Seattle, Iceland Air will start flying Seattle, Reykjavik, Iceland, where you change planes and you can go onward to London, Paris, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Stockholm, Helsinki, for prices that have been announced as low as $550 and $600 round trip to inaugurate this new service of Iceland Air that will start from Seattle, although they will continue to fly from New York, from Boston, from Minneapolis, from numerous other cities at remarkably low prices. For the months of July and August, they have listed some dates when they will be offering a $499 round trip fare between New York City and London or Paris, provided only that you go there via Reykjavik and make a change of planes at Reykjavik and then go on. To the extent that Iceland is suffering, Ireland is suffering just as badly. And all of you are aware of the fact that the famous economy of Ireland, which caused the nation to be referred to as the Celtic Tigers, has so collapsed in recent months that Aer Lingus is once again offering to Ireland this coming summer the same prices that in previous years they used to charge in the winter. And today, if you go to a company called Sceptre Tours, S-C-E-P-T-R-E, you will find that you can enjoy a 1-week fly-drive program to Ireland, picking up a car in Dublin, having that car to drive for a complete week, receiving a booklet of vouchers entitling you to bed and breakfast accommodations and a full Irish breakfast every morning. And in July and August of this coming year, you will pay $799 per person for that package on Aer Lingus, and you'll pay perhaps $200 more out of San Francisco, changing planes or taking another plane cross-country and then hooking up with a flight leaving from there. So to China, to India, where the unit of currency as recently as a year ago was selling at a rate of 39 rupees to the dollar. The exchange rate is now 51 rupees to the dollar. And for $15 a night, you can rent a decent hotel room in Mumbai or in New Delhi, for you can make use of a new website called Mahindra Homestays, M-A-H-I-N-D-R-A, that will enable you to live as a paying guest in the affluent home of an affluent Indian family in New Delhi, in Calcutta, in Bombay. And these remarkable savings and these remarkable opportunities are now available to us. Side by side with the developments in the field of currency and in terms of the low cost of air tickets that one is now encountering. And by the way, when I bought a one-way ticket to go to San Francisco on one of the airlines last week, I found that ticket selling for $158 from New York City, one way. And if you will go to the internet, you will find domestic airfares within the United States that on certain days, not on all days, but if you search around, you find them selling for a price that has never been experienced before, which is being offered by airlines that are absolutely frantic about filling their planes and continuing to operate in these economic conditions. But side by side with those individual developments, there are several themes that we are now encountering in travel that I think can be of tremendous benefit to you in planning and undertaking trips over the next several months. The first is the emergence of a new category of airfare search engine known as an aggregator. Up until now, the moment that the internet was introduced as a tool for planning travel, we have all been dealing primarily with airfare search engines of giant companies whose names were Travelocity, Expedia, and Orbitz. Companies that list the airfares between certain city pairs in the United States and then sell you a ticket for the itinerary that you choose. And very grave questions have been raised recently about the impartiality of these giant companies and whether they have undercover deals with certain airlines and whether they give preference to airlines whose prices are actually higher than those of certain cut-rate carriers whose prices they don't even list. They are now being superseded by a category of internet search engine known as an aggregator, a company that simply performs a journalistic function, that simply tells you what the airfares are between U.S. cities and between international cities, and then leaves it to you, once you choose the flight that you want to book, it leaves it to you to contact the airline directly to actually purchase the ticket. In other words, from an aggregator, you do not buy tickets. You simply learn from them what the prices are. The largest of the aggregators is a company called Kayak.com, K-A-Y-A-K.com, but it has a competitor named Sidestep.com. There's a company called Fairchase.com. Amazingly enough, there's a tiny little company headquartered in Copenhagen, which is a aggregator for U.S. domestic airfares. If you want to fly between San Francisco and Duluth, Minnesota, and you go to Momondo, you will probably find lower airfares than if you go to a U.S. company. From the aggregator called Momondo, who does not sell the ticket but just tells you what's happening. And it's obvious that a little Danish company has gone to all the airlines and said, we're too insignificant to be noticed. Give us preferential rates and we'll sell them. And that's exactly what they're doing. But I would suggest that for your own next trip, to be absolutely certain that you are getting an advantageous airfare like the airfare that I discovered for a one-way ticket to San Francisco by going to an aggregator rather than to these other companies. A second major trend in travel recently is the replacement in part of the famous escorted motor coach tour anywhere in the world by a new type of tour program called the small group adventure. Let me explain the background of it. Most people who want to go travel in a group aided by an escort have in the past booked themselves onto tours operated by escorted motor coach in which you join 45 other Americans and you are put into a motor coach where there is a young personality kid who performs the lectured commentary as you travel around. This is known as an escorted motor coach tour. It's a relatively inexpensive method of traveling. But I, for one, and I'm sure I reflect your opinion for, as well, I, for one, would rather die than place myself in a motor coach holding 48 other people. I did it once in my life, and I found after the first day that I was hiding in the back seat of the back row, rather, of the motor coach so that no one else would associate me with the 45 other people that I was stuck with. And because there is such an animus against this method of travel by an intellectually curious, well-read type of American tourist, that four companies have recently scored an enormous success in travel by offering a different type of group program for people who want to travel in a group. They recognize that there are a great many Americans who are independent, spirited, well-read people who want to go to all the exotic, remote, far away, little visited countries of the world, who would like to see Bolivia, who would like to go to the Fiji Islands, who would like to go to Romania, who would like to go to the destinations other than Paris and London and Rome, but who want to do it in a group. They don't want to be a complete pioneer. They want it to be with a few other people and with an escort, a trained, experienced person who will help them along the way. And in response to that need, four foreign companies have formed tour operations, 90% of whose product is being sold to U.S. citizens, that are called small group adventure tours. The word adventure does not imply any risk of life. They're simply, they are not sending you on tours that involve rope climbing or rock climbing or whitewater rafting. They are sending you simply to the little visited foreign and exotic destinations in groups that never consist of more than 12 people. The groups do not possess a vehicle for traveling around. The group travels by public transportation. And when they go to the capital of Ecuador and they need to go to the next city, they go to a train station and they get on the train and they book public transportation and travel about exactly as residents of the country travel about. They make use only of locally owned accommodations. They place their visitors in private homes or in small pensions or guest houses or small individually operated hotels. They do not sell round-trip airfare to the destination in question, but simply rely upon their passengers to obtain their own airfares and to group up and to arrive on a certain day at a certain congregating point and join the tour. And for a two-week tour of virtually any place in the world today, these four companies are charging approximately $800 per person, all-inclusive, not including, again, the cost of air transportation for reaching the destination in Costa Rica or wherever it will be from where the company, the group operates. And these are called small group adventure tours, and literally, it used to be tens of thousands, it's probably hundreds of thousands of American tourists are now booking their vacations through such companies. The biggest of them is a Canadian firm called Gap Adventures, G-A-P Adventures, and I think you'll be fascinated to go to the internet this afternoon or this evening to see the hundreds of departures that they offer for $800 per person in groups limited in size to 10 or 12 people, making use of local transportation, but accompanied by an experienced guide. There's then an Australian company that has made a great success operating in the United States called Intrepid Tours, whose program is also on the internet. You have a Dutch company called Joser Travel, D-J-O-S-E-R, whose small group adventure tours are booked half by residents of the Netherlands who have to agree that the entire trip will be operated in English. And that even though half of the people on them are from Holland, English is the language used. And finally, there's a company in California that everyone has mistakenly feels is a true blue American-owned company. It's really owned by the British. and it's called Adventure Center. It is located in Emeryville, California, and it, too, operates hundreds and hundreds of these adventure tours. And finally, I don't have the time to go into all these trends. I should point out that there's a tremendous surge in the booking of vacation programs by Americans that operate in academic institutions found in English-speaking universities all over the world. There are now thousands of Americans in the summer who book one-week stays at Oxford University or at Trinity College Dublin or within the United States at St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at Cornell in Ithaca, New York, where for one or more weeks you as an adult, without taking or passing entrance requirements or taking tests or receiving a grade or credit, you return to the liberal arts and you return to the happiest days of your life, which are your memories of college. And though you in the San Francisco area in particular should always keep in mind that the stellar program of this sort is operated by the great book school of the United States, which is St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where the undergraduate curriculum is usually 4 years spent reading the 100 acknowledged works of the Western civilization. During the summer, in July and the first week in August, St. John's College opens its residence halls to adults of all ages from all over the world to come and live in a student residence, to eat in a student dining room, and to spend two sessions a day, morning and afternoon, for one complete week, reading two of the great works of the Western tradition. And my wife and I, several years ago, had one of the great vacations of our life when we went to St. John's. And at that time, you simply spent the week reading one book, and we devoted an entire week to studying, to reading, and then arguing about in a seminar with famous instructors of St. John. We read Thucydides' The Peloponnesian Wars for one complete week, and we then went back another summer to read Dante's Inferno, to go to our room and read 50 or 60 pages every night, and then the next morning to spend 4.5 hours in a seminar classroom of St. John's talking about what we had read with two acknowledged experts in the mind and thought of Dante. This program is not yet sold out for this summer. I checked last week. It is available for about $1,100. For that amount of money, you go to St. John's for 1 week this July or early August, and you read the great books in a modified program where by now you choose two books that you read and you discuss one in the morning for an entire week and the other in the afternoon. It's a fabulous, thrilling, memorable opportunity in travel. I will finish up because I don't have time to finish all of the subjects I wanted to talk with you about. I will finish up by pointing out that I am in the West Coast this week because I am pursuing a book tour on behalf of a book that I think is the most important book that I've ever written, which is called Ask Arthur Frommer, that started out as an encyclopedia of travel but was retitled Ask Arthur Frommer by marketing experts who regard the word encyclopedia as a downer, as a depressing title. In that book, I not only talk about some of the trends, some of the prospects for travel that I've talked about here, but I also talk about the problems of travel and about what travel should mean to people. I have always regarded travel as an opportunity to experience difference in lifestyles, in political attitudes, in theologies, as an opportunity to go to communities all over the world in which people have beliefs which are diametrically opposite from yours, and where you are made to reassess your beliefs and to think over what you believe is important and where you study the different solutions that people all over the world bring to various social and urban problems. This type of travel runs against the grain of the commercial travel industry because their effort is to send you to places where you experience America several thousands of miles away. where you live exactly the same life and follow the same values as you do here at home. And this effort by them to dumb down travel, to which I devote a great deal of the new book that I've written, Ask Arthur Frommer, this is found today primarily in two industries. One, the cruise ship industry, and the other, the resort, the people who operate all-inclusive resorts. The cruise ship is now being converted by every major cruise ship company in America into giant amusement parks maintained in metallic boxes that just happen to float on water. The average cruise ship today, the new cruise ships are being built to house a minimum of 3,000 people. There's a new cruise ship coming out in a month from now, the Norwegian Epic, that will house 4,400 people. And then in November of this year, we have the Giant that will set the pattern for all the future from Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines, the Oasis of the Seas, carrying 6,000 passengers and 3,500 people in staff, so that 9,000 people are crammed onto this metallic box resembling the orgone boxes that various hallucinating psychologists wrote about in the 1920s, where on the ship are hundreds and hundreds of recreational activities designed to distract you from the fact that you're floating on the oceans of the world or that you are engaging in a travel experience. They have bowling alleys. They have rock climbing walls. They have boxing rings. There are actual boxing rings, or one or two of these. They have theaters showing you how to cook. They have classes in gardening arrangements and the like. They are so full of distraction and so obviously aimed at a young clientele that the question arises, why do they need even to go to sea? Why aren't these boats simply docked permanently in a pier, saving all sorts of money in terms of fuel, dispensing with the captain, with the experienced sailors and all the rest, whereby you could reduce the price to $20. Well, that's the kind of subject matter that I discuss and ask Arthur Frommer, and there are many others as well. But I'm told that the format for these discussions is to have a speech for about 35 minutes, and I've gone beyond that. And after that, we do Q&A. So thank you very much for your attention to the talk today. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Our thanks to Arthur Frommer, founder of the Frommer Travel Guide Series and author of the new guidebook, Ask Arthur Frommer, for his comments this evening. Mr. Frommer, we do have a number of questions for you, and I do mean quite a number of questions. So let's start off with the first one on the list. The Lonely Planet guides are aimed at the backpacker crowd, the Let's Go series for the college crowd. So who would you say is the ideal audience for the Frommer guidebooks?
We have always said that we were not writing our guidebooks for younger people. We were not writing them for backpackers. We were writing them primarily for people, well-read people, who have an intellectual curiosity about them and who want to understand and experience the authentic aspects of the foreign countries to which they travel. We have guarded travel not as a trivial recreation, but as an immensely important learning activity. We have stressed the lessons that you get from travel rather than the recreational activities of travel. And that type of attitude, which was first conveyed in a little book that I wrote called Europe on $5 a Day, which was a lawyer's brief. I'm a lawyer by training. That attitude has led to a company that now publishes 340 guidebooks a year, each one rewritten and revised each year, which are the largest selling travel guides in North America. They now account for one out of every four travel books sold. So that's my answer there.
With that in mind, are there places in the world that you can go to for $5 a day, which are safe to go to for $5 a day?
There are places where you can go for close to $5 a day. The island of Bali in the Pacific is a wonderful area of the most gracious people on earth who actually enjoy your being there as a tourist and who invite you to their ceremonies, their rituals, their cremations, their marriage ceremonies, and there you can live for $10 a day, let's say, not for $5. You can live almost for $10 a day in Honduras, which I referred to in the basic part of my trip. The $5, unfortunately, is out of the window, but one can still travel inexpensively. And even if the conditions to which I referred reverse themselves, if the price of oil suddenly skyrockets, if the value of the U.S. dollar suddenly plummets, you can continue to travel affordably simply by substituting for normal hotel accommodations, alternate accommodations. And again, one of the themes of all of our books is the fact that there now are alternatives to the standard hotel that cost a fraction of what hotels charge and that bring you a more enjoyable, a more authentic, and a better experience. These are vacation homes, they're vacation apartments, they're hostels, they are bed and breakfast houses, they are convents and monasteries. There is a whole world of accommodations that are now a big business as well. There's a company in Austin, Texas, that has become a giant company called HomeAways that simply brings to your attention the availability of apartments in every major city of the world that you can book for a fraction of what you would pay for a hotel. They tell you about vacation homes that you can book in the resort cities of the Sunbelt states of the United States, in Orlando and elsewhere, for a fraction of what you would pay in the United States. And I think that affordable travel is simply a matter of decision making, to say to yourself, I am never going to pick up the burden of staying in a hotel. I'm going to rent an apartment. I'm going to rent a home. I'm going to stay in a monastery. I'm going to stay at a guest house. There's even a new website that was launched last week called Airbnb, Air Bed and Breakfast, by a number of young people who have discovered thousands of people around the world who have purchased air mattresses and now rent you an air mattress in their apartment in a spare room where you may be. And they are doing wonders. They are excelling in those cities that are totally sold out of hotel space during conventions and the like. And that is another alternative. I'll answer the questions in a shorter space from now on.
These are excellent answers. That actually segues well into our next question, in that how has the Internet changed both positively as well as negatively the nature of travel?
Well, I think its effects have all been positive. It brings to your attention all sorts of facilities and bargains and opportunities of which you would otherwise be unaware. On the other hand, I am not a fan of the so-called user-generated websites on the web, in which publish recommendations sent in by the public of hotels and restaurants that they advise you are superb institutions. It has become clear to everyone today that 60 to 70% of the recommendations that you find in websites like TripAdvisor and the like are fake, that they are sent in by the very hotels that are touting their own advisability or criticizing their competitors. And I'm not happy with that trend in Internet production, but the Internet is a phenomenal instrument to use. And one of the Internet sites that you might want to go to is my daily blog, which appears in Frommers.com/blog. You'll read a blog that I have to write every night before I go to sleep at night. I can't go to sleep before I write 3 items to put into that blog that contain what I've learned about travel during the course of the day.
In your remarks, you commented with respect to the impact of the economic recession upon the industry and some of the positive benefits to it. There are a number of questions about if there's any concerns with respect to the safety of airlines, cruise ships, and hotels and the like as a result of the economic impact.
I generally find that most travel facilities are safe and most travel destinations are safe. The only places that are unsafe to visit are the obvious ones whose names we all know about. Travel facilities have become less comfortable than they used to be. It is now a cattle car mentality that chooses the space between seats on the flights of United Airlines and American Airlines. And I really very much recommend that you try to fly on Virgin America and on JetBlue instead. But I don't think there's any great safety issue that has been raised by the economic slowdown. I think that the airlines are not cutting corners in terms of safety, and I think that luckily there's a regulatory framework that prevents them from doing that.
Since you mentioned the airlines, in your book you mentioned you speak about the new fees that have been coming in place that the airlines have been imposing, the baggage fees, the food fees, the breathing fees, everything associated with it. And you have some actually interesting comments about how this may be actually good for a traveler.
Well, it's good for a traveler who's able to travel without luggage of any sort, without eating a meal. You know that there's a particular monster in England named Michael O'Leary, who is the president of Ryanair, a cut-rate airline, who seriously suggested a few weeks ago that there be a charge of £1 to use the bathroom on board the planes that he operates. He has recently installed scales alongside the check-in counter so that overweight people have to pay higher for their air tickets than people weighing below levels that he has established. But you find this all throughout the industry today, and the only people who can avoid these extra charges are people who fly without luggage, because generally every airline is now charging you at least $25 for the first bag and $50 for the second bag. And if you want to check three and four bags on the plane, you're paying hundreds of dollars nowadays. It's a mark of desperation on the part of the airlines that they're trying to make money out of additional items. But in the meantime, they are charging for their tickets the lowest prices that I, for one, have ever seen in recent years. This is now the time to travel. It's not that we should joke or take pleasure in the misfortune of people who have lost their jobs or whose portfolios have been decimated. But nevertheless, ironically enough, this is a remarkable period for traveling, and I hope that you'll all go home and book a trip to China or to Western Europe in the coming weeks.
One of the there are a number of questions with respect to the recent events of swine flu and also its impact upon Mexico. So I'd be interested in your comments upon it and what this means for travel, and also your thoughts on swine flu itself.
A professor of virology at Oxford University recently issued a statement that if the swine flu epidemic becomes a pandemic, if it runs out of control, that it will get to us wherever we live and regardless of what we do. And therefore, he says, therefore, go anywhere. Do what? There is no way to protect yourself against it. And that was shown today, I believe, on the news. I heard the little country of Costa Rica, of all places, now has 56 known cases of swine flu. In a tiny little island, a tiny little Central American country of that sort was simply simply had the misfortune of probably being visited by people who came directly from the affected areas in Mexico. But there is nothing that any of us can do, certainly, about the swine flu epidemic. Okay. I hope that the United States is now spending a lot of money to stockpile medications for the possible reoccurrence of the swine flu epidemic this coming fall, which is a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to happier subjects, there's a number of questions with respect to different destinations, so we'll go through a few and would be interested in your comments. Many people are inquiring about Italy, where to go, places to see. So what are some of your highlights, things you absolutely must do while in Italy?
Oh, my. I would have to speak for weeks to respond to that.
And I'll give you a minute.
One of the great bits of advice I have is that when you go to Italy on your next trip, delegate to one of the members of your party the job of going into a local real estate agent to learn whether he has any villas that are available for the coming summer in the Italian cities near which you are traveling. When you deal with a local real estate agent in Italy for that kind of rental, you are paying one-fifth the rental charge that you pay to an international real estate broker who makes the same villas available to you in the United States. Several years ago, Roberta and I were in Florence, and I just happened to walk into a local real estate agent, and he told me, yes, he had a villa that came available to him that morning, and he put me in his car, and he drove me to the outskirts of Florence, and there I saw a medieval three-story villa with five bedrooms, with four baths, with grape orchards, with olive trees, with a view to die from of the Tuscan landscape. And when I asked him how much this would cost for a month, he listed a figure in lira, which it took me a little while to translate into dollars, and I suddenly realized that he was saying $3,000 for the month, a villa for $750 a week. We rented that villa for the entire month of September and came back a year later to enjoy it, having made the terrible mistake, unfortunately, of telling all our relatives that we had, and cousins from whom I had not heard in years just happened to discover that they would be passing through. And Roberta and I worked hard cooking meals for them the first several days until we finally thought of going into Florence, and we hired a lady who lived in Florence who was willing to come out to our villa every afternoon, chopping herself and making the meals for this enormous number of guests that we had the entire month in Florence.
I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Arthur Frommer, founder of the Frommer Travel Guide Series, and author of the new book, Ask Arthur Frommer, about how to travel during these troubled times. Continuing with our theme of different destinations, a one that many people are interested in is the possibility of travel to Cuba. What are your thoughts with respect to it?
The embargo against travel to Cuba is not only, in my opinion, unconstitutional, a violation of our First Amendment rights. My own belief being that government has no more right in peacetime to tell us where we can travel than it has the right to tell us that we can't write a book or attend a lecture. It will be opened up. The embargo is also unbelievably counter-effective. And when you go to Cuba, as I have twice in the last several years, you were in the city of Havana surrounded by thousands and thousands of tourists from Italy, from Canada, from Germany, from France, from every country in the world other than the United States. It was a stupid bit of policy. It should be overturned. It's a fascinating country to visit, and I think, and you should jump to book when it's overturned, as it soon will be. Apparently, there is legislation that's been advanced in Congress that has a chance of being passed that will end this counterproductive embargo against trade with Cuba.
Looking at a different destination with a bit of a reverse embargo, one of the audience members writes, several years ago, I toured Libya when U.S. citizens were allowed a visa. What are the prospects of Libya opening up again?
Of Libya?
Libya.
I would never go to Libya. I mean, Libya is this repellent government that actually admitted its complicity in the downing of the Pan Am flight years ago, and which continues to operate as a one-party state. I just wouldn't go there. I regard the country as being so loathsome and the government so loathsome that I wouldn't go there.
So I'm going to turn over this next question about would you go to Libya?
nor would I go to Burma. Nowadays, I believe it is the right of every human being to make up their own mind as to what countries you're going to boycott. The one thing that I'm against is government telling us that we have no right to go to a particular country. Throughout the years when Nelson Mandela was in prison and apartheid was the official policy of the Union of South Africa, I refused to do any travel to South Africa. I refused to publish a guidebook to South Africa, to have anything whatsoever to do with them. However, if our government had issued a decree that we couldn't go to South Africa, then I would have been on the next plane going there. And I think that I reflect your viewpoint there, too. Thank you.
In your book, you do comments about the U.S. State Department advisories with respect to travel.
Yes.
What are some of the things that a traveler should take away from those advisory?
I find that the advisories are too broad and that they sweep in too many potential hazards. And I tend to follow the Australian advisories rather than the U.S. State Department's advisory. There is a similar service that is operated by the Australian government, which I think is a much more realistic statement of what areas of the world are unsafe to travel to. But I would not rely on the U.S. State Department advisory. And I hope that Hillary Clinton will improve that situation. But for the time being, I would pay no attention to it at all.
So we covered a couple of places you would not travel and also who you would not take advice from. So what are some places that we must travel to? What are the destinations that absolutely have to be on our bucket list?
Every human being at some point of their lives must go on an African safari. You must go to an area of the world to see what the world was like when human beings did not walk upon it. And there are now African safaris that are being offered for $2,000, including round-trip airfare from the United States to Nairobi and about 5 days in the games parks of Kenya and Tanzania. And I regard that as one of the indispensable visits that everyone at some point wants to make in their life. Everyone at some point in their life has got to go to Egypt and to see the ruins of the ancient Egyptian civilization. I think it's entirely safe to go there. It isn't that cheap any longer to go there, even though everything there is dirt cheap. And they, too, have a currency that has collapsed against the U.S. dollar in these times of economic crisis. And it is a mysterious phenomenon, and I've never heard a logical explanation of why our currency suddenly has shot up, except the explanation that other countries are suffering worse than we are, which is why our dollar is benefiting. But Egypt is another indispensable destination. I regard China as a trip that every American must make, that you will not understand the world or the future issues that we will confront in this world without yourself going to China. And when you have this incredible $999 opportunity to fly from San Francisco, I would go there directly to their office. You call up China Focus, by the way. It's hard to understand the English of the people who answer the phone, but they are operating, and I have had cousins who have taken this $999 visit to China and who rave about it. They use decent hotels. They give you decent meals. You don't eat that well when you go on an escorted tour to China because you're only taken to touristic restaurants. Only when you go independently that you see how good they do in that area in China. Anyway, those are the indispensable visits that I think that every human being at some point in their lives should make.
Excellent selections. The next question, I'm going to admit it's a bit biased because I wrote it. Is where do you see the role and future of travel agents in your travel?
Those travel agents who are worth the extra fees that they charge will continue to prosper. But a person in choosing a travel agent should only go to a travel agent who possesses some special knowledge of the destination or the property that they are recommending to you. The days when a person who himself does not travel could be a successful travel agent are gone forever because, as all of you know, it costs more to use a travel agent than to make your own arrangements. The airlines are no longer paying a commission to travel agents, so you have to pay a hefty charge for the use of a travel agent. And the number of travel agents has declined significantly in the time since the airlines ceased paying commissions. And I think that you should carefully choose a travel agent, that you should use the same methods that you would adopt for choosing a dentist or an accountant. You would ask for references. You would ask for other people who have used them. You would cross-examine them, ask them whether they themselves have actually been to the destination that they're recommending to you, or have they actually seen the hotels that they are suggesting that you be placed in. And unless they have some bit of additional information of that sort, I would not use a travel agent. I think you can do it best by yourself.
Okay. I didn't appreciate the thoughts on it.
This word is going out to, 215 radio stations that carry this rocket? My name is Mud now. Mud, travel agent.
Anything but. There are some questions here with respect to how you think we should incite and excite the next generation of travelers, particularly with the allure of the internet, of Xboxes, of all the items available before them. How would you advise people to convince their grandkids that they need to go to Europe on $15 a day, maybe?
In other words, how I would advise young people to undertake a trip to... I would make sure first that they are not too young. I have never been in favor of traveling to Europe or to any foreign country with children under the age of 8 or 9. I don't think that they benefit at all from that type of travel. My daughter, who has 2 children who have traveled extensively when they were 4, 5, 6, and 7 years old, vehemently disagrees with me and finds that her children... my grandchildren have benefited from that type of travel, but I don't think that we're going to have to persuade young people to travel. I think they will all, that the opportunities are now just so widely available. The number of schools that are now sending students, even public schools, to foreign countries for different purposes and for different projects is so great that the youth of America are not going to need to be persuaded to do so. I think they'll find their way there. And that is so different from the life that my own response to Europe. I was drafted. I graduated from law school in 1950, at a time when no one went to Europe. When you'd hear of a classmate who had a rich uncle, who had given them as a graduation present a trip to Europe, but you never thought that you yourself would go there. And after having gone through basic training and then advanced infantry and being in a unit that was going to be sent to Korea, someone discovered that I had certain linguistic abilities, and I was sent to Berlin instead. And that's how a lawyer became a travel writer and a travel publisher. And it's been quite an adventure, and it's all summed up now in Ask Arthur Frommer, I think. But I very much have enjoyed, as you could see, talking with you about travel, and I could go on for many, many more hours tonight.
Though, unfortunately, we have reached a point in our program where there is time for only one last question. So with that in mind, could you describe your next trip, the next one that you yourself are planning, and can we join you?
I've looked over the entire world and discovered that the only country they haven't been to yet is Chile. And Chile has a female president, among other things, and it has a political program completely the opposite of what used to prevail there. And I'm planning to go to Chile and to spend much more time visiting the countries of Latin America. I think that they are too overlooked by us in our travel planning. And certainly it was fascinating recently to return to Mexico as we did. But it's fascinating only when you get out of the all-inclusive resorts and you travel independently. I have been to resorts in the Dominican Republic that are famous for being all-inclusive. They provide you with everything, and therefore you never leave the grounds of the resort. You have no contact whatsoever with the Dominican Republic. And I've discovered that several of these resorts all simultaneously have scheduled a 2 p.m. class every weekday in dancing the merengue. And 100% of the people staying at these all-inclusive hotels go running into the ballroom to learn how to dance the Dominican merengue from an American dance teacher. And, of course, they're all Americans dancing with each other, and that is the sole contact that they have during their entire vacation with the culture and the life and the people of the Dominican Republic. So I hope to travel independently for a great many more years, as long as I can keep doing it. I celebrate my 80th birthday 3 months from now. Thank you. And that 80th milestone is the new 60, by the way, because I'm as busy as ever. And thank you so much for coming to attend to the birthday. Thank you again.
Our many, many thanks to Arthur Frommer, founder of the Frommer Travel Guide Series, the author of the new guidebook, Ask Arthur Frommer, for his comments. We also thank our audience here and on the radio. I'm Mark Casto of Casto Travel, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is hereby adjourned.